place where they told you what to chase, told you how to run the race. Every move was on the page, but I didn't like their way. Had to fight.
Part 1.
You'll hear a student asking for advice on her accommodation. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. Now we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
Good morning. So, what can I do for you?
Well, it's about the accommodation where I'm staying at the moment.
First, can you give me your name and address, please?
Yes. I'm Maria Dominguez, and the address is 12 Pine Tree Terrace. It's in Westcliff. I'm staying with two other students. There's actually 4 of us in the house, us 3 students and the lady who rents the house to us.
So, is there a problem?
Well, there are a few, actually. You know, I'm a first-year student, and though I lived away from home for a while when I was studying over the summer in Mexico City, I've never lived abroad, and it's a big change for me. The course is tough, but that's not the main difficulty. I'm coping with that up till now, anyway.
The accommodation was arranged for you by our office, wasn't it? It's a nice place by the sea.
Okay, but it's difficult. There are only a few buses, and it takes about 50 minutes. It's just so far away, and there's no way I can get back if I want to stay on after 7. And also the other thing is, there's nothing to do there. It's basically just a village. All my friends stay on campus.
What about the girls you live with? Do you get on with them?
Well, when I see them, but one of them is hardly ever there. Mostly she stays in a house with friends. They've got plenty of extra space, you see. The other girl is quiet as a mouse and hardly ever leaves her room. The landlady's friendly enough, though a bit forgetful, and she doesn't keep the place very clean. I don't have any real problem with her as a person, though.
I understand it's rather far away. So I suppose you'd like us to find you a place in the halls of residence, or closer by in the town.
That would be good. You did say in your brochure that most first-year students are offered a place in halls.
I think it actually said final-year students have priority there. They need the library facilities more for studying for their finals.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
Anyway, let's see what we can do. Just a moment, I'll check what might be free. Sometimes students drop out or move from halls, though we were full at the beginning of term. By the way, have you checked the student notice boards? You know there's one in each of the 4 colleges, don't you? There are often requests for people to share houses, and it can be quite cheap.
No, I hadn't thought of that, but it's a bit of a risk living with complete strangers.
Now, I see there's a room free in Hillside College.
That's the one with the tall tower, right?
That's it. It's the smallest college and has a reputation for being quite fun. Oh, but it's a shared room. Would you consider that?
That's going to be a problem for studying, isn't it? What if she plays music all the time, and maybe we won't have anything in common?
Maria, I see you're studying history. So is this girl, Francesca. She's Italian.
Well, at the moment I'm doing the general humanities course, which includes history, but actually I'm planning to change to literature quite soon. That's not the thing, though. I really want a room on my own.
Right. I'm afraid I don't see any other openings. There's nothing showing up on the computer, at least on campus.
Well, if I have to stay where I am now, I'm going to find it more and more depressing.
Here's one more thing we can try. The university owns several places on the Thanet Road, and also by the West train station. Both of these are about a 20-minute walk down the hill. They're not the newest of buildings, but I could check for you. Can you come back tomorrow? Oh, no, that's Saturday. What about Monday?
Yes, sure. I'd really appreciate it if you could do something for me.
Let's hope so.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a tour guide welcoming a group of visitors to the British Library and telling them about the library and what they will see there. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your very own tour of the British Library on this lovely afternoon. My name is Tony Walters, and I'm your guide for today. Could I please see your tickets for the guided tour? I'd also like to remind you that any tickets bought today do not include a visit to the reading rooms. I'm afraid we don't do visits on Fridays, or any weekday during working hours, so as not to disturb the readers. But if you do want to see those rooms, the only day there are tours is on Sundays. So, I don't want anyone to be disappointed about that today. Okay? Thank you. Right, we'll start with a brief introduction. As many of you know, this is the United Kingdom's National Library. And you can see that this is a magnificent modern building. It was first designed by Sir Colin St. John Wilson in 1977 and inaugurated by Her Majesty the Queen more than 20 years later in 1998. As you can see, the size is immense and the basements alone have 300 kilometres of shelving, and that's enough to hold about 12 million books. The total floor space here is 100,000 square metres, and as I'll show you, the library houses a huge range of facilities and exhibition spaces, and it has 1,000 staff members based here in the building. So, you can appreciate the scale of our operation. In fact, this was the biggest publicly funded building constructed in the United Kingdom last century. It is still funded by the government as a national institution, of course, and it houses one of the most important collections in the world. The different items come from every continent and span almost 3,000 years. The library isn't a public library, though. You can't just come in and join and borrow any of the books. access to the collections is limited to those involved in carrying out research. So it's really a huge reference library for that purpose. And anyone who wants to consult any materials that are kept here can formally apply to use the library reading rooms.
You now have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 16 to 20.
Right. Well, here we are, standing at the meeting point on the lower ground floor, just to the right of the main entrance. I've given you all a plan of the building so that we can orientate ourselves and get an idea of where we'll be going. Now, outside the main entrance, you'll see the wide piazza with the stunning sculpture of Newton. The sculptor was Paolozzi, but it's based on the famous image by William Blake, and it's definitely worth a closer look. On the other side of the piazza from the statue is the conference centre, which is used for all kinds of international conventions. We'll take a quick look inside at the end of our tour. Looking ahead of us now, you'll see that we're standing opposite the staircase down to the basement, where you'll find the cloakroom. And to the left of that, we have the information desk, where you can find out about any current exhibitions, the times of the tours, and anything you need to know, if you don't have a tour guide. As you can see, on this lower ground floor, we also have a bookshop. That's the area over to the left of the main entrance. You'll be free to browse there when we get back to the ground floor. Now, opposite the main entrance on this floor, we have the open stairs leading up to the upper ground floor. And at the top of them, in the middle of the upper ground floor, you can see a kind of glass-sided tower that rises all the way up through the ceiling and up to the first floor. This is called the King's Library. It's really the heart of the building. It was built to house the collection that was presented to the nation in 1823 by the king. You can see it from every floor above ground. When we go up there, you'll find the library's treasures gallery on the left. Can you find it on your plan? That's the exciting one. So we'll be visiting that first, but we'll also take a look at the stamp display situated behind it on the way to the cafe. A lot of people miss that. The cafeteria runs along the back of the floor, and in the right-hand corner, you'll find the lifts and toilets. Always good to locate them. The other main area on that floor is the public access catalogue section, and I'll show you how that operates when we get up there.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turn to Section 3. Section 3. You will hear a dialogue between two students, David and Jim. First, you have some time to look at questions 22 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 22 to 25.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, David. I'm glad I found you. I've got a topic for our presentation next month.
What is it?
I thought it would be a good idea to talk about glass and how it's recycled.
That doesn't sound very interesting.
That's what I thought, but it is. Did you know that glass has been around since as early as 4000 BC, when glass was used in the Middle East as a glaze to decorate beads?
Is it really that old?
Yes, and by 1550 BC, coloured glass vessels were widespread and used for cooking and drinking. The earliest known clear glass is a vase found in Nineveh in Assyria, dated from around 800 BC, which is now in the British Museum here in London.
You know, I think I've seen that. I was at the British Museum a couple of months ago with Lisa.
We don't realise how valuable glass was. It wasn't used widely back then. Until the 18th and 19th centuries, glass was very expensive and was used for limited applications, such as stained glass windows for churches. Large-scale glass manufacturing began with the Industrial Revolution, with the mass production of glass containers beginning at the onset of the 20th century, and glass light bulb production automated in 1926.
How expensive?
I don't know. But nowadays glass is much less expensive and is taken for granted as a packaging material, in addition to its use in windows and other applications.
Do you know what glass is made from?
New glass is made from a mixture of four main ingredients: sand, soda ash, limestone and other additives. These additives include iron for colour, brown or green, chromium and cobalt for colour, green and blue respectively, lead to alter the refractive index, alumina for durability, and boron to improve the thermal options. Annually, total glass use in the UK is estimated at around 3.6 million tonnes. Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 26 to 31. Now listen and answer questions 26 to 31.
You're kidding. That's phenomenal. What do we do with all that glass? Where does it go?
Using present technology, the UK glass industry has the capacity to recycle over 1 million tonnes of glass each year. And this, coupled with the material's unique ability to be infinitely recycled without compromising its quality, creates a compelling case for the recycling of glass. Despite this, glass makes up around 7% of the average household dustbin, and last year over 2.5 million tonnes of this material was landfill.
How can glass be recycled?
It can be recycled indefinitely as part of a simple but hugely beneficial process, as its structure does not deteriorate when reprocessed. In the case of bottles and jars, up to 80% of the total mixture can be made from reclaimed scrap glass, called cullet.
What's it called?
Cullet. C-U-L-L-E-T. Cullet from a factory has a known composition and is recognised as domestic cullet. From bottle banks, it is known as foreign, and its actual properties will not be known. Recycling two bottles saves enough energy to boil water for 5 cups of tea.
You know, I wouldn't mind a cuppa now.
Did you know that recycling reduces the demand for raw materials? There is no shortage of the materials used, but they do have to be quarried from our landscape. So from this point of view, there are environmental advantages to recovering and recycling glass. For every ton of recycled glass used, 1.2 tons of raw materials are preserved. Recycling also reduces the amount of waste glass which needs to be used as landfill.
I know. It's a social conscience we all need to have.
Taking part in recycling the waste we produce makes us think about the effects we are having on our environment and enables us to contribute towards a greater level of sustainability. It's not all about economics, you know.
I'm sure you're right, Jim.
That is the end of section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You'll hear a lecture on MSG. First, you have some time to read questions 32 to 41. Now listen to the conversation and answer questions 32 to 41. You've probably noticed that MSG appears regularly among the ingredients of your favourite foods. But what is it? How long has it been used? How is it used? MSG, or monosodium glutamate, is a chemical commonly used to add flavour to salty or sour tasting foods. The average person knows almost nothing about it, but today MSG is found in everything from potato chips to soup. Its principal component is an amino acid called glutamic acid or glutamate. It was identified by Professor Kikune Aikida in 1908, but Eastern cooks have been using glutamate-rich seaweed as flavouring for more than 1,200 years. Glutamate is found in two forms. Bound glutamate, which is linked to other amino acids forming a protein molecule, and free glutamate, that has no link to protein. Only free glutamate is effective in enhancing the flavour of food. Foods often used for their flavouring qualities, such as tomatoes and mushrooms, have high levels of naturally occurring free glutamate. MSG is usually produced through fermentation of corn, sugar beets, or sugar cane. The finished product is a pure white crystal, which dissolves easily and blends well in many foods. Monosodium glutamate enhances the basic flavour of many foods. New studies also show that MSG elicits a unique taste that is known as umami in Japan and often described by Americans as a savoury, broth-like or meaty taste. Umami may be the fifth basic taste, beyond salty, sweet, sour, and bitter. As an integral part of cuisines around the world, this savoury taste is common to the bouillons of Europe, the oyster sauce of China, the soy and fish sauces of Southeast Asia, the pizza of Italy, and the chowders and stews of America. MSG helps bring out the best natural flavours in a variety of foods such as meat, poultry, seafood, and vegetables. While MSG harmonises well with salty and sour tastes, it contributes little or nothing to sweet or bitter foods. Results of taste panel studies indicate that a level of 0.1 to 0.8% MSG by weight in food provides optimum enhancement of the food's natural flavour. This is within the range of glutamate that naturally occurs in foods. Approximately 1/2 teaspoon of MSG is an effective amount to enhance the flavour of a pound of meat or 4 to 6 servings of vegetables or soup. MSG is a self-limiting substance. Once the proper amount is used, adding more contributes little to food flavour. Overuse of MSG, as with many other seasonings and spices, may cause some foods to have an undesirable taste. There is simply no substitute for wholesome quality food and good cooking techniques. MSG makes good quality food taste better, but will not improve the flavour of poor quality food. Disturbingly, scientists have known since the 1960s that MSG kills brain cells in young animals. Further research suggested that MSG may also be responsible for ailments ranging from skin rashes to irregular heartbeat and depression. Reports vary on just what percentage of the population is sensitive to MSG. One researcher put the figure as high as 30%, but food industry-sponsored studies have suggested it as low as 1 to 2%. Baby food manufacturers agreed to take MSG out of their products in the 1970s, but it is still widely used in other foods. This is because MSG is an economical way of stimulating great taste. If you're making a chicken stew but can't afford a whole chicken, why not use a little chicken and a lot of MSG? Consumer groups in the USA campaign regularly against its use, but for many of us, MSG will continue to be a part of everyday life. Food, it seems, will always be a matter of personal taste.
That is the end of part four.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Tell me.